Welcome to NESG Radio. My name is Shay Vincent. I am your host for today. As you may know, World Health Day falls on 7th of April. The theme for 2025 is Healthy Beginnings, Hopeful Futures. This year's theme will urge governments and the health community to ramp up efforts to end preventable maternal and newborn deaths and to prioritize women's long-term health and well-being. So this interview is going to delve into ending preventable and newborn deaths, which is obviously a critically important issue, particularly in countries such as Nigeria. Today, my guests are Dr. Maria Saleh and Dr. Laz Udeze. Dr. Maria Saleh is the thematic lead, Public Health Thematic Group, NESG Health Policy Commission. She has 17 years of experience designing, implementing, and monitoring public health programs. Dr. Saleh has specific program technical and operations leadership experience spanning 8 years in integrated health systems strengthening interventions, integrated service delivery, governance, health financing, supply chain, health policy, and advocacy. My second guest, Dr. Laz Udeze, is a health management and development consultant. He's a public health physician, health policy and management specialist, and sustainable development consultant. His professional experiences across multiple countries cut across clinical practice, academic research, and public health project management. Dr. Laz is the founder and CEO of Talk Health Niger, a fast-growing health communications and public health consulting firm. I'm looking forward to a very insightful conversation with our experts today. Welcome, Dr. Maria and Dr. Laz.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Shi. It's good to be here.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you for being here with us. Okay. So as you know, Nigeria has one of the highest maternal mortality rates globally. In 2017, Nigeria's maternal mortality rate was estimated at 917 per 100,000 live births. It has increased by nearly 14% in 2020 to reach 1,047 deaths, placing Nigeria third globally. Dr. Maria, what are the key drivers of preventable maternal and newborn deaths in Nigeria?
All right, thanks, Dr. Shei. I would say the major drivers are, you know, weak infrastructure, poor access to quality services, and then we also have socioeconomic and cultural barriers in Nigeria. So if I could expand on those points, for healthcare access, we tend to have very poor quality prenatal delivery services, postnatal care across the country. An assessment by the National Primary Healthcare Development Agency a few years ago showed that, I think, out of the 34,000 or so primary healthcare centers in Nigeria, only a quarter met, you know, the minimum standards to provide care. And most of these tended to be more in urban areas. So the rural areas tend to inequitably, you know, suffer poor access to quality services. Now, on the point of healthcare infrastructure, we tend to have, where these facilities have met the minimum criteria, you would find insufficient supply. So in terms of medicine, you wouldn't find the medicine available when the client needs it. You would have shortages of skilled healthcare providers. For example, the minimum standard for delivery is to have 4 skilled bed attendants in a primary healthcare center. And if you even would find one, you know, that's, you would be very lucky. So what that now leads to is overburdening of higher levels of care. You know, they would now, instead of focusing on deliveries with complications or, you know, needing special care, they now have to be providing routine care. And then in terms of equipment as well, there are some basic equipment that should be available at a primary healthcare center and even higher level centers, and these tend not to be available. My third point was on socio-economic and cultural barriers. So we have, especially in certain regions of Nigeria, lower educational levels, which means people are less likely to read information and be aware of, you know, issues pertaining to their health. We have some cultural practices that, you know, can deter women from seeking timely care. A preference for traditional birth attendants, who, while, you know, are a very important part of the health system, are not particularly skilled, especially in dealing with complicated deliveries. I will just pause there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Maria, for outlining those critical issues for us. Okay, so I think you've already touched on some of the issues that will cause disparity across states. But let me just pose this question to Dr. Lars. So, Dr. Lars, despite existing policies and programs, maternal and newborn health outcomes remain poor in many states. So we're aware of, you know, the disparity across states. So what are the biggest gaps in Nigeria's healthcare system that must be addressed? Can you just speak to these gaps and, you know, how these gaps can be addressed?
Thank you very much, Shay. You know, Dr. Maria had, you know, highlighted some key factors that are responsible, and looking at states, you know, they vary depending on different factors, you know, across states in different parts of the country. The barriers you could have, looking at it from the perspective of the building blocks of the health system, the biggest challenge we have now is lack of healthcare workers. It's not as if we had enough. We've never had enough. But among the ones we have, we're having increasingly depreciation in the number of healthcare providers in the country. A couple of years ago, the Medical and Dental Council of Nigeria released data on the number of doctors per state. So using the total population of the states and the total number of licensed medical practitioners working in those states, and it showed wide disparity. Of Lagos has highest concentration of health workforce for obvious reasons. It's a cosmopolitan city with huge concentration of private healthcare providers, you know, compared to like a state like Sokoto or Kebbi. You know, there's wide disparity, but In terms of solving this problem, it has to start from taking actions, implementing the recent policies, you know, the 2024 policy by the federal government that is aimed at retaining the health workforce and discouraging brain drain, rapid emigration of various cadres of the health workforce, especially the nurses, the medical laboratory scientists, and the doctors. Every state governor has to be intentional to conduct some kind of need assessment. How many healthcare providers do we have, and how many do we need for the available public health facilities? A public health facility should be a standard, you know, and also enforce same for the private ones, moving from primary healthcare facilities to tertiary care. That's something that is really needs to be done. And also other forms of needs, and that needs assessment that has to be conducted, speak to human resource need, facility and infrastructural need, that of the laboratory, medical supplies, drugs, and the appropriate facilities for keeping vaccines. As the safety and security of the health facilities also a factor. If you go to some parts of the country, especially where you have security challenged areas, you also see that, you know, the health access to quality healthcare is almost non-existent because the health facilities are deserted. The health workers had to run for their lives. And these are things that are not even within our direct control in the health sector. So securing every part of the country, especially states where you have all various forms of insurgency, is also a way. Health workers have been kidnapped in some states. Cross River is one of those states where there's been a lot of reports of medical workers being abducted and held for months. So these are some of the factors. So on the specifics is for every state to do a needs assessment and pin down the causes of its own problems and why it's peculiar, and have political will deploy resources, budget sufficiently for health based on needs and based on things that matter, and pay well, attract health workers. Nigerian health workers are going elsewhere because of the condition of work. Payment is not just the issue, but also an environment they will consider safe enough. So retention of the health workforce is perhaps, to me, the most critical factor at the moment. And also encouraging local production. Over 80% of our health commodities are imported. So if we produce more in country, it will also help some areas that are grossly underserved. They will have better access to some of these commodities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lars. So the importance of safety, that's increasingly becoming a problem, across the country. So you talked about states needing to do a needs assessment and deploy resources based on needs, the importance of workers being well remunerated, and again, safety concerns needing to be addressed. Thank you very much for that. Okay, so Dr. Lars, I think we'll stick with you. So now, moving on to policy, governance, and financing in healthcare. How well did Nigeria implement the National Strategic Health Development Plan? I know a core priority of that plan was to address high maternal and child mortality rates. There have also been other plans and policies that have been aimed at this very critical issue. So we also have Nigeria Health Sector Renewal Investment Initiative and other policies in that line aimed at reducing maternal and newborn mortality. How well have these plans fared? What issues have arisen, and what can be done to ensure that policies that are aimed towards addressing maternal and child mortality actually meet their objectives?
Yes, that's a very good question. The National Strategic Health Development Plan is a good document, and I must say that Nigeria does well in terms of the quality of policies we develop, and a number of countries come to use our policy documents as a template. But unfortunately, the implementation usually doesn't go as planned. And sometimes we go to countries who borrowed our policy to learn how they implemented, so that's kind of ironic. So, but having made that point, I think the first step is having every state to domesticate these policies. And when every state domesticates this policy, every state having its own strategic plan. Right now, I can't really say that each of the 36 states and the Federal Capital Territory have a strategic plan. And when every state have its own plan and they are able to implement it, that helps. Because if you look at the country, the federal mainly controls the tertiary facilities, but have no control in what happens in primary and secondary health system. So, but a lot of times we expect that, okay, the federal government, we have huge expectations on them. So the Nigerian Governors Forum have to begin some kind of ranking, appraisal, monitoring and evaluation, or if not the Nigeria Governors Forum, or even the Federal Ministry of Health, as part of the monitoring aspects for each of these policies, let's begin to have a monitoring framework where on annual basis, I love the fact that we've started the State of Health reports, the current Minister of Health, the National State of Health reports, which is a very good step that has been taken and has to be continued. Next step is to begin to, you know, using defined indicators to rank the performance of all the states on those defined indicators, the maternal and child health indicators, non-communicable diseases, every aspect, including on health financing, including on all the pillars of the health system. It's been shown that when you have a kind of dashboard or a scorecard, it stimulates some kind of healthy competition where states want to outperform each other in terms of results. You know, so that is going to be quite helpful. The Health Sector Renewal Investment Initiative approved, I think, last year or 2 years ago. Also, a very solid policy document. I won't be able to say how well, it might be too early to perhaps assess how well it has contributed in improving the health system. But I think that investment, by removing barriers to local investment in the health sector, is quite critical. Enhancing access to active pharmaceutical ingredients, taxation of some critical elements required for local production of medicines and medical products, you know, by that policy have been removed. I don't know to what extent the implementation has been, you know. This investment renewal initiative is something that is quite commendable, but also the states have to make their states attractive and provide support to local industries to make this big. The pharma sector, the medical production industry is huge, that has, you know, massive benefits, not only for the health system, but also to the economy. And of course, we know that there is direct correlation between a healthy economy and even the quality of life, not just for mothers and children, but for everybody, for every family. So it has far-reaching implications when it's well implemented. So let me stop here for now. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Lars. Okay. So, Dr. Maria, over to you. So we know the government has often, you know, fallen short of budgetary allocation to health, you know, due to fiscal challenges. How can the government sustainably finance maternal and newborn health programs, particularly at the sub-national level?
All right, thanks for that question, Dr. Sheyi. To start with, maybe we should just quickly look at what the current initiatives are around, you know, maternal, newborn health. There's, under the sector-wide approach that the current administration started a year or two ago, there's an initiative called the Maternal and Neonatal Mortality Reduction Innovation and Initiatives Program. So that's MAMI. And within that, I think one thing that's commendable is the prioritization of high burden local government areas in terms of, you know, efficiently using available resources. So the government has prioritized 172 local government areas, which, you know, have a population of about 22% or so. They contribute 22% to Nigeria's population, but contribute about 55% to the maternal and newborn health mortality burden. Now, this has helped to, like, you know, mobilize more resources, because one, donors can see that there's a clear strategy, so they are more likely to buy into such an initiative. However, I feel like there's more that needs to be done from the state level and now from the LGA level. this program, I don't know if it's very clear how states can, buy into it, invest in it. It's, to me, it's clearer at the national level, but at the state level, it's not fully clear. That being said, as more states are being onboarded on that program, I believe it's now 2 states that have rolled out this initiative. As more states are onboarded, we can see more clearly how the state is financing these initiatives and how the local government is also contributing to the initiative. Another mechanism is the Basic Healthcare Provision Fund. It does cater for maternal newborn health services. However, with the MAMI initiative, we need to make sure that this Basic Healthcare Provision Fund is also prioritizing the other local government areas where, there might not be so much emphasis on, but there's still maternal and child death and newborn deaths going on. I think the third aspect in terms of financing that's not fully, optimized is the private sector. It would be good to see a model or several models that the government will come up with where they are able to leverage private sector resources, not just financing, but also health workers and the rest. This is very critical because I believe about 60% or so of maternal newborn health services are delivered by the private sector. And so this is a very critical area that the government needs to take care of. Public-private partnerships that would expand financing and service delivery coverage, quality service delivery coverage. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. So we see both the public and the private sector having important roles to play in terms of provision of resources and not just finances. Thank you very much. Okay, so Dr. Lars, we'll come back to you. So I know you kind of touched on the importance and the availability of a monitoring framework currently. So the question to you is, what accountability mechanisms are in place to ensure that maternal health policies translate into tangible improvements at the community level?
Yes, thank you for that question. The accountability is an aspect that, in my view, we do not do well generally as a country, not just in the health sector. People don't like to be held accountable. And it's an area that there is a lot of work to do. Apart from the surveys that we do, like the National Demographic and Health Survey and some other ones being conducted by the federal government with the support of partners, which kind of give a sense, we do not have sufficient accountability measures to ensure optimal performance. So how do we fix this? Let's look at primary healthcare. Literally over 80% of our health needs could be met if we have a functional primary healthcare. And that's the rationale for the Basic Healthcare Provision Fund as provided by Section 11 of the National Health Act 2014, putting in more funds. So right now, in terms of implementation, instead of being some kind of additional fund, is almost treated like replacement fund. We are not quite tracking sufficiently how the impact we've made through this fund. This is an area that we need to look more at on state-by-state basis. At the state level, what role is the local government playing in health? The primary healthcare under one roof essentially took management of health facilities, coordination, monitoring, evaluation, and even financing to the federal to the state government through the primary healthcare development agencies at the state. But by the constitution, there are some aspects of primary healthcare. Primary healthcare goes beyond what happens in the health facilities. So we've not clearly defined issues around health education. There's a national health promotion policy which prescribes some roles for the local government. Nobody is tracking that. And when people are not knowledgeable, education that should happen in their local dialect, the language they understand, that is culturally sensitive. You know, that's not happening. That should be happening and led, funded by at the local government level. Water and sanitation issues, especially environmental protection, looking out for food vendors, cleanliness of the environment, hygiene, are issues, the things that, you know, we should be, there should be accountability, people held accountable. It's not quite happening. It's something that we need to establish, because all these things are determinants of health. You know, so they determine the number of persons that could get ill and go to primary health facilities. And now that we do not have sufficient human resource to even cater for these people, it's cheaper to invest in those aspects. And both public and private sector can actually play roles if there is a framework that could make it easier for private partners, not just the donors, but even for profit partners, especially in the area of waste management. This is something that have a lot of benefits economically, health-wise, disease prevention, you know, and it's something that the local government should champion. So in terms of accountability, the roles of everybody should be clearly defined. On paper, on policy, yeah, some of these have been defined, like the World Health Systems Policy, prescribed responsibilities for village health committees, ward development committees, community health committees, but many of these committees are not even aware of it. So we should begin from there to sensitize leaders at these levels, and that brings to the leadership and governance component of the health system. Leadership at the village, community, ward levels up to local government system. These people are very critical. Most of the conversation we are having in primary healthcare is happening in Abuja and bringing the state officials to Abuja, but not so much is happening at the state level. So we need to establish a model, or at least a checklist for actions should be happening at the village and community level, driven by the state. So while I recommend that the federal should have a scorecard or ranking for state performance, at the state level, they should have the same for local government. And at the LGA level, they should also have a performance framework or monitoring framework for communities or villages. If we could establish this, have an objective measure to rank this on annual basis and bring it out from community, from local government to state to federal, and publish them, people will begin to ask more questions, and citizens will begin to participate more. And that's how we'll begin to ask more questions on how our financial resources, how well it's been used, and how our health workers posted in these areas have performed. And accountability will just take its natural course and help to improve outcomes.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. La. So we're going to stick with you. We're going to shift a little bit towards access to quality care and health system strengthening. So you've kind of touched on that. Thank you for highlighting the critical importance of accountability mechanisms. So now the question is on access to skilled birth attendants and emergency obstetric care. How can this be improved, particularly in rural and underserved areas?
Yes, thank you very much. The NDHS 2023-2024, showed there's some slight increase in terms of access to skilled birth attendants compared to the previous years, but still is below what is required. So how can we improve this? It still begins from problem identification, knowing the extent of the problem, and at state by state level, every state should be able to conduct their needs. What do we need? There's a midwife service scheme, a very brilliant initiative in my view, that was introduced in 2012 or thereabouts, where midwives are hired and sent to places that is more in need. The federal government was to pay them for 2 years and the states to take over thereafter. But after the 2 years, the states didn't take over, and that essentially led to the collapse of that. And the midwives who have been sent to some areas had to leave. So states needs to map the assessment of the needs, and when they identify these needs, they now set up a plan on how to train more skilled, like more midwives. Most of the states have School of Health and Midwifery, or School of Nursing and Midwifery, or School of Health Technology. So they will phase in that, okay, it might take us this number of years to be able to produce this number of healthcare providers. So to meet the state needs, there was a project I was part of over a decade ago that kind of supported maternal and child health in Jigawa State. And to meet the health needs, the recommendation was that the state should set up a school of health and school of nursing and midwifery, which they did. And that over time helped to increase the number of available health personnel. So when this is noticed and that training, the state will need to invest and also bring private partners where necessary. Why is always important to run this as a business is that it makes it more sustainable when there is a business model to it, you know, in some level of public-private partnership. It makes resources, you know, used more efficiently. And apart from training them, providing the skill set, environment that will make them enjoy their work is also needed. Within the state, they will know areas. Training people from the particular area will also be helpful, so that they wouldn't need to move, start renting apartments, and you know, some people could just live in their home and go to work and provide those services in a culturally sensitive manner. And because they are from that community, they will be trusted. Gender consideration is also very important. We know that some parts of the country, you know, is not allowed for someone of opposite gender to attend to women who might be going for antenatal services, and that in itself is a barrier. So where you have mostly male providers in an area where it's not culturally acceptable for males to attend to females' obstetric needs, you know, we now have to intentionally encourage girl child education, you know, and also support as many girls and women as possible to go through this training and provide enabling environments for them to provide the services. So making the health place conducive and fun for the workers is something that is really good. Right now, many people with these skills are leaving us, and some who are available are overworked. And those who don't have the temperament to withstand the pressure display their frustration to the patient, which also makes them feel like, oh, they are rude towards us, you know, so let's go to the traditional birth attendants because they are more friendly, you know. So creating an environment that's you know, holds everybody accountable and make sure that health workers discharge their duties professionally and with empathy, you know, is something that has to be addressed. It might be just easy to single out to say, okay, these health workers are rude. Yes, nothing justifies being rude, but at the same time, providing an environment that will make some of those behaviors less prominent will also be helpful, while those who engage in that are held accountable for such behaviors. So these are just some of the measures I think could help enhancing those assets. Or again, looking at the, you know, there's these three obstetric delays, first delay, second delay, and third delay. I think the second delay, you know, speaks to the delay involved in moving to a health facility to access care. So some are geographic barriers, some are lack of ambulances or lack of vehicles to access this thing. These are also some of the factors that makes it difficult for some persons to get skilled care. So state by state, community by community, members of the community can be involved in preparing solutions to have some transporters. They could make arrangements so that if a pregnant woman goes into labor, there's a number that could be called, and those persons can take that woman to the nearest health facility if they were not there earlier, you know, to access care, and ensuring that if they are too indigent to be able to pay, there's a mechanism to cater for that. So these things are things that can be solved community by community, because primary healthcare is built on with the expectation of community participation at every level. And I think some of the gaps we are witnessing is that communities are not sufficiently participating in primary healthcare, and that's a major gap that has to be filled.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lars, for your answer that really delves into the myriad of issues affecting the availability of skilled birth attendants, particularly in the rural and underserved areas, and also the availability of emergency care. Okay, so Dr. Maria, I'll come to you. Let me try to roll up two questions in one so we can save some time. Okay, so what role does primary healthcare revitalization play in reducing maternal and newborn deaths? How can PHC centers be strengthened? And more generally, how can the quality of maternal and newborn care be improved in both public and private healthcare facilities?
All right, that's a loaded question. So Dr. Lars mentioned this, you know, the primary healthcare system or centers are the most important part of or component of achieving universal health coverage. So it serves as the first point of contact. And if we are to meet our universal health coverage goals and targets, you know, we need to revitalize them in a way that we can provide basic care to at least 80% of our population. Recall that I mentioned only 25% or so meets minimum criteria, and this is the public sector, which is providing about 40 to 50% of healthcare services. So PHC revitalization is critical, but it also needs to extend beyond the public sector and into the private sector. Now, what are some of the things that can be done to revitalize primary healthcare? We do have, you know, a large number of facilities across the country. What we now need to do is to make sure that, you know, they are working and functional. And what makes them functional, this includes very critically having skilled healthcare workers at the PHC level. We do not currently have the numbers employed that can, you know, provide the care that's needed. So massive recruitment, retraining, training, and retention strategies. Dr. Lars had mentioned a few earlier, but I think in addition to remuneration, there may be other benefits that the government can leverage that can help to retain some of these healthcare workers. That being said, there's also a large number of healthcare workers that are unemployed, especially at the lower level. We know that, you know, doctors have better options once they are done with their training, whether it be going to the private sector, opening their own business, going into residency, or more commonly, you know, leaving Nigeria. But then the lower level healthcare workers who, you know, I think they are really our best bet right now. You know, what are we doing to engage some of these people once they're out of school? Yes, recruitment is important into the public sector, but then how are we improving the quality of care that they are providing within the private sector? Is there something we can do with the private sector that leverages this huge number of healthcare workers? For example, there was an assessment that, you know, I supported last year, and it showed that within the PPMV, that's patent and proprietary medicine vendor ecosystem, in two states, there were about 6,000 healthcare workers working in 3,200 or so PPMVs. Now, that is a huge number of healthcare workers. I pretty much don't know of any state where you can have that number of health workers within, you know, the public sector. So knowing this, what are some of the strategies we can use to engage these people in within their own healthcare businesses and within the public sector to provide care? One was the CHIPS, that is the Community Health Influencer Promoter and Services Initiative, which has now morphed into a more robust community care healthcare worker program. The major shift now is moving from just lay health workers to also including junior community health extension workers. These, you know, provide a conduit to me to getting more people into the PHC system, getting more people to use healthcare services. But what that means now is that we need to make sure that equipment are functional, there's electricity in every single PHC, there's water supply, constant water supply, and that there are medicines for maternal and newborn health. There are some basic medicines that must be present in every PHC, and we need to make sure that those medicines are present. Dr. Laz had also referenced, you know, a presidential executive order that was signed last year that was meant to improve or encourage local production of medicines. Many of these medicines are already produced in Nigeria. What more can we do to get these products more readily into the hands of the private sector? Are we investing in supply chain? Are we investing in the private sector to assist them getting these medicines to the last mile? Basic equipment as well, delivery kits, I mentioned electrification as well. How are we leveraging our local resources to make sure the PHCs are electrified, etc. Now, on the issue of improving quality of care, I would say most importantly, in terms of reducing maternal and newborn mortality, we need to take a life course approach. So looking at how we are, you know, at every stage of the life of an individual, how are we optimizing their engagement with the primary healthcare system and delivering, you know, the interventions that they need to be able to have babies that thrive, in order to have women who are healthy, they go through pregnancy in the most healthy way possible. So looking at it from, you know, adolescence, we look at nutrition programs, we look at family planning being available when, even to adolescents, making sure family planning is available if they need it. And then when they get pregnant, there are some essential interventions that they need to get. They need to get their vitamin supplements, hematinics, etc. Those need to be available to them. And when it's time for them to deliver, there are some basic things that must be available in the delivery suite. If there are complications, they should have access to emergency transport systems. Now, how can we make sure that the quality that's been delivered to these individuals, you know, meets certain standards? The first thing to do is to standardize clinical guidelines. We do have a plethora of guidelines. The main issue is, you know, are they being implemented at the lowest level? Have we implemented a kind of a quality improvement or quality audit system for both public and private facilities? Those have been implemented by different partners working with government, but to be honest, it's been very patchy. And what we now need to do is large-scale implementation, I believe, to increase the quality within our public sector and our private sector. The next thing that's extremely critical in improving the quality of care is strengthening training, pre-service training and in-service training. So pre-service training is when they're still in school, and in-service is when they are already in employment. How are we deploying training in a very efficient way? Traditionally, you would have, a five-day training for a very small component of maternal newborn health being delivered. And this even affects the quality of care, because the health worker needs to leave, go to a training venue, a hotel or whatever, get trained for 5 days, comes back, and then another component comes in and they end up being absent from the facility for many days. Now we need to be more innovative. What are some of the approaches we can use to deliver this training with minimal disruption to services? So for example, blended learning platforms, so they can use their phone, learn, improve their skills, and then maybe just 1 or 2 days for the practical sessions. Another critical component for improving quality of care is supportive supervision and mentoring. I know the government had standardized supportive supervision a few years ago, but to be honest, I haven't seen where, you know, it has been taken to scale. They were able to come up with, you know, tools, resources, put them on a platform, but I don't know if that data is being analyzed for even those facilities that are being supervised. So we need to, you know, put in more effort in ensuring this is done at scale and that we're analyzing the data and using it to improve the quality of care. One last area I want to touch on is on licensing and regulation. Within my role, as part of my role within the NESG, there's an effort to, you know, set up the federal government's effort, I should add, to set up a healthcare regulatory, a health facility regulatory agency. So that's still in process, but that would be a significant milestone in scaling up some of these things I mentioned. So making sure that health facilities, not just professionals, are licensed, but also health facilities are licensed. There's regulation, both for the public and private sector. A component of that, which, you know, of licensing, which may or may not be controversial, depending on the states we're in, is traditional birth attendants. I think at the federal level, there isn't really any framework for engaging them. And my understanding is that this is not a practice that's encouraged, but we must acknowledge that they are a significant player in provision of healthcare services, especially for maternal newborn health. And some states have actually recognized this. We have in Lagos State, in Cross River States, and several other states. I would also want to mention, you know, nurse-led businesses or health facilities, these maternity homes and nursing homes. They are more prevalent in some states than others, but I think this is one other mechanism of ensuring we are delivering quality care, because they have been trained, they've gone through to the School of Midwifery, Colleges of Nursing Sciences, and so we need to make sure that, you know, they continue to deliver quality maternal newborn health services. You know, how are we engaging them in these trainings that I've mentioned before? How are we making sure that when they go back for their licensing, they have actually met, you know, some minimum criteria? If there were any issues, for example, you know, any death that happened in their facility, how are we making sure that we have, you know, investigated that death? Are we making sure that they even notify the authorities appropriately? And that has now reminded me that I forgot a very critical part of monitoring quality in maternal newborn deaths, and that is MPDSR. So that means maternal and perinatal death surveillance and response. So this is actually a very critical component of improving quality of care. So it ensures that, you know, reviews are taken for any deaths that occurred in a health facility, These are documented and that improvement measures are put in place. Thank you very much. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Mara, for your very robust answer. But before I let you take a breather, very, very quickly, because we're running out of time, on community engagement and cultural barriers, I know you spoke a little bit about cultural barriers earlier. What role do traditional and religious leaders play in promoting maternal health? And how can they be better engaged? So if you can just answer in less than a minute, that would be great.
I believe they play a very critical role, particularly in Northern Nigeria. They serve as gatekeepers to many communities, especially those ones that traditionally have a lower engagement with the healthcare system. I think one thing that can be done with them, I think it's better, they are better engaged, let's say, on the immunization side of things than on maternal newborn health. There's a better structure on that side, and I think we can leverage on that structure. So engaging with those community leaders, training them on maternal newborn health issues. Now, this is not a new intervention. It's been done, but it's not been done on a large scale. So it's mostly in a project style approach. If there's a partner working in a state, they then engage the traditional leaders. And, you know, once the project is over, that's the end. But we need to be more deliberate and get them to, you know, engage continuously in and take more ownership of maternal and newborn health outcomes in their community. And so this could involve training, supporting them to deliver birth preparedness, helping them to set up those emergency transport systems that Dr. Laz mentioned earlier, helping them to come up like scenario planning in terms of handling complications of pregnancy. And then I think Nigeria is a very religious country, and there are many platforms, you know, which we can leverage, whether it be on, you know, the Christian side or the Muslim side, which are the two dominant religions in Nigeria. There are platforms which we can leverage to promote, you know, messaging on the importance of antenatal care, importance of using contraception, spacing, you know, pregnancies. These are all important interventions to reduce maternal and newborn mortality, reducing girls getting pregnant too early and women having babies too late. And most importantly, or very importantly, also encouraging institutional deliveries. Dr. Laz had referenced the NDHS 2023 to 2024, where there was a slight increase. I want to just mention that it was a 1% increase over 2018 data. So that's 1%. Yeah, that's sort of a significant increase, but it's not enough based on the targets that Nigeria is meant to meet by 2030. Then lastly, you know, now that the LGAs are hopefully will now be more active, since the PhD Under One Roof initiative happened a few years ago, we need to engage them more so that these local health management systems, the ward development committees, can take up more of a role as envisioned when, you know, those documents were being written. So instead of just being, you know, mechanisms for, you know, accountability for the Basic Healthcare Provision Fund, they need to also take up more of their role in ensuring good outcomes for every single woman who is pregnant, every baby who is born. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Great, fantastic. Thank you very much. So, you know, yeah, we've had a very robust conversation. We've talked about, you know, a range of issues. So finally, let's just look into digital health. So, Dr. Laz, I'll come to you. How can Nigeria leverage digital health solutions, mobile health, and telemedicine to improve maternal and newborn health care access? I know that there's been a lot of conversation around these areas. So, what are the opportunities, and how can Nigeria leverage these technologies? Please, if you can just keep it very brief, that would be much appreciated. Over to you, Dr. Laz.
Yeah, thank you very much. The digital technology provides huge opportunities to be leveraged, especially given the paucity or the low number of health workforce. So it enables us to leverage both those who are within and those who are not right here. So how can we do that? Various ways, but one of those ways is even extending the digital infrastructure, especially to some hard to reach communities or underserved areas, because places where you need this support mostly may not have the infrastructure to even use some of these technologies. So that is not directly under the Ministry of Health, but the digital economy, NIDA, and NICECOM, SATS, all those institutions might have to play some roles in this regard. Then school system, improving digital literacy is also something that we have to ensure that primary and especially secondary schools, they have computers that the children will learn with. And with that, the ability to use these technologies will be easier. When you roll out these services, mothers who have basic education will have the minimal literacy to be able to use them, so that you don't need to start doing any round of special training for them to be able to use them. So equipping our school system, especially at the primary and secondary schools, with computers to enhance digital skills and literacy will be helpful. Then there are a number of services that are already there deploying telemedicine. This could be expanded, and when the infrastructure is made available and the demand is increasing, naturally there will likely be more investment in that regard in a very sustainable manner. And I recommend that the government would partner with relevant private organizations that have experience in this area to be able to support the public system to take full advantage of these technologies. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much. Okay, so Dr. Laz, just to round up, so we'll stick with you. So if you had to recommend two urgent actions to the Nigerian government or development partners or civil society to accelerate progress in maternal and newborn health, what would they be? Please keep it brief. Thank you.
Number one is enhancing community participation in primary health care. That for me is the biggest gap. Sometimes government deploy equipment to health facilities and they get missing because the community is not even aware. Nobody is helping anyone accountable. So it will help in promoting accountability. It will also help in having more investment where philanthropists, individuals, and communities will be part of the processes and solution. Then number two is enhancing monitoring supervision. So when we are able to track progress and also reward people based on results, that will help to drive other factors that will enhance performance, efficiency, and effectiveness in managing available resources towards promoting maternal, newborn, and child care. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Okay, so Dr. Maria, I'd like to pose the same question to you. Two urgent actions to any of these key stakeholders to accelerate progress in maternal and newborn health?
I think to me the most critical is funding. Overall, we don't have enough funds, but then even where they do exist, it isn't efficiently used and there's a lot of wastage. To your point, or my main point is, fully fund and operationalize all of these initiatives, whether it be the Basic Healthcare Provision Fund or the MAMI approach, ensure that they are fully funded and efficiently, and the funds are efficiently used. The second one is on skilled birth attendants. This is extremely critical in ensuring, in reducing maternal and newborn mortality. There's a strategy to reach to have at least one functional primary healthcare center in every ward. The government is working towards that. I would like to also see a scenario where, you know, in order to fast track progress, the private sector is also engaged in that drive. It doesn't mean that, you know, it has to be a public PHC that's functional. It could be a private PHC, which then gets linked to health insurance, and women can have, you know, a safe delivery. So I'll just pause there. Yeah, those are my main points. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Maria and Dr. Laz. It's been very insightful. I think, you know, we've covered many of the, you know, critically important issues that are, you know, determinants of maternal and neonatal health in Nigeria. So thank you so much for joining me to talk about this very important issue.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Same here. Thank you.
Thank you. So for this and more episodes of NESG podcast, please visit www.nesgroup.com/podcast. Until next time, thank you for joining us. Bye for now.